My name is Ed Goldberg. Welcome to Author Author, an occasional series of conversations with authors touring through Portland or whom I have reached by phone. My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Alex Christie. Alex, welcome to All Classical. Welcome to Portland.
Thank you very much, Ed. Nice to be here.
Yeah, have you been to this city before?
Long ago, about 20 years ago, but okay. Not since.
Yeah, but you're basically a West Coast kid.
I'm a West Coast kid.
Okay. Absolutely. Title of your book is Guttenberg's Apprentice, and it's published by Harper. And I was telling you before we started talking that I had a bit of a revelation about your book in this sense. It's got a lot of characters in it. It's got a lot of situations in it. It's got a lot of history in it. But I decided that it really all comes down to a fairly simple story. And the story is about a young man who was apprenticed to Johann Gutenberg at the time in the 1450s when the first Bible was produced by movable type. And it's about the shop around Gutenberg's work. He's the master of the shop. I'm curious about whether Peter Schaeffer, the young man who becomes the apprentice, whether he's based on a real character or is he out of your imagination?
No, in fact, he is based on a real character. And one of the reasons that I found this story so compelling is when I started researching it, I discovered these two other men who had sort of been hidden in Gutenberg's shadow for the last half a millennium, his financier, Johann Fust, and this young man, Peter Schaeffer, who's the hero of the story. He was, in fact, a scribe in Paris. He shows up in the documents of the lawsuit because this tremendous, I'm sure we'll talk about it, this tremendous undertaking exploded in recriminations at the end, on the side of Fust as a witness. And they continued as printers. He was the first major printer in the West and actually founded the Frankfurt Book Fair. He was an immensely important guy, but not very well known outside of printing circles.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is the 1450s. Well, actually, you have a framing device where you have Peter talking to Trithemius, who's an abbot, who is, I'm not quite sure what his function is. He's a bit of a historian, or is he doing something for the church here?
He's an amateur historian. There was, you know, in the Middle Ages, they had this sort of ambition to write the entire history of the world in one book, and you kind of could. So he was a chronicler. He was a self-appointed chronicler. And because he was quite a young abbot, he was very ambitious. He wanted to build up his library. And he wrote about, he actually did encounter the real Peter Schaeffer in 1485. He wrote about it in two of his chronicles. And in one in particular, he spent some time asking Schaeffer to tell him about the invention of printing because he wanted to put it in his chronicle. So that framing device is based on a real conversation that happened, and I thought it was a great way for me as a novelist to also give the character the opportunity to look back, reflect on what they had done when he was a young man.
And this is 30 years after the fact,
correct,
pretty much.
Exactly.
Now, this is a very fraught time. I mean, the first, I realized, I realized this 50 years ago, but that when Gutenberg's Bible came out, that time, in the mid-1450s, is also the time that Constantinople fell to the Turks in the east, and Europe was in a frenzy. The church was felt attacked. The whole culture was changing because there was a middle class emerging. The merchants and the manufacturers, the traders, were creating a moneyed class which had not existed before. And all this is going on at that time. And then 30 years later, when he's talking to Trithemius, that's around the time that Martin Luther was born.
It's the beginning of that movement. You know, the press started that movement, and you're exactly right. It was kind of an edge time in history when all of these forces were in conflict. And the fall of Constantinople, as you said, that was the death knell of the Middle Ages. It marked the beginning of the end for the Catholic Church. And the other death knell was the printing press, because once this growing middle class that you talk about, and in Mainz, this conflict was really acute between the Archbishop of Mainz and this growing merchant class, of which Johann Fust was one very leading member. His brother was on the city council. He was, in fact, the mayor. And so there was this demand for learning by the younger. And it's a bit like our time now with globalization, you know, where you have the access and the ambition and the appetite from people who've been excluded historically. And in Paris, where the universities were, and in Bologna, where Peter Schaeffer had been in Paris, there was this demand for text and demand for learning that propelled this need for a way to provide books. So Gutenberg understood that there was a market for books because the scribes could not write them fast enough, essentially.
Yeah, and the ability to read was a rare ability, a rare bit of knowledge, which still mostly came through the church, yes?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it was an interesting time because you had parallel governments. You sort of, there wasn't really government per se, there were fiefdoms, you know, it was a patchwork time, especially in the Holy Roman Empire, which is Germany and Austria and Hungary. They were run by very small dukes and earls and these local principalities. And then you had the church and Rome as kind of a parallel government. But the Pope had the ability to excommunicate you, and it was a profoundly religious time. You can't even, religion was the world. You know, God decreed everything that a man did, and there was a divine plan, and everyone fit into it. So the church had this complete grip on people, and they didn't hesitate to use that spiritual power as a weapon. The archbishop, for example, in Mainz, when the book opens, he has just slapped the city with a ban of excommunication, which is a terribly brutal weapon to force the middle classes to rescind their effort to get a little more freedom and a little more fairness, you know. So there was this real tug of war between the church and the middle class.
Parenthetically, I remember my sophomore year in high school when our world history teacher told us that the Holy Roman Empire was not holy, was not Roman, it was not even an empire.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Now the archbishop, he's a piece of work. His name is Dietrich.
Yep.
Archbishop Dietrich is a tyrant. I can't imagine any other word for him. He uses the power of the church to crush people that disagree with him.
Yeah.
And Pope Nicholas at the time, Nicholas V, was that what it was?
That's correct.
He's got his hands full with Constantinople, and he's trying to raise an army to fight the Turk. And one of the ways that he does that is to sell indulgences.
That's right.
And we'll get into that in a second.
Okay.
But one of the things that Gutenberg is, and I'm not really sure how he feels about this, because you've created Gutenberg as a complicated character. And I don't mean complicated in the current sense, which means that you're either unwilling or unable to explain something, so you call it complicated. He was truly a complicated man. I have no idea what his motivations were. But Gutenberg is afraid that his invention, his baby, it's going to be used merely to turn out printed indulgences. Tell us about that.
Well, this was the whole dilemma, I think, of writing about a period that is so long ago, and the documentary evidence is scanty, to say the least. Gutenberg's life is very, very well documented because he's the great man of Germany, and they've dug up all of his genealogical records. We know everything about his family. But in this key period of time, between 1450 and 1455, there is almost no evidence. And the reason for that is because they had to operate in utmost secrecy. For precisely that reason, that he had been, as he says in the book, he had been burned by the church before. He had tried to work with them. He was from the upper classes. His godfather had been an advisor to Dietrich 20 years prior. So he moved in that circle, but he kept his distance from that circle. He had worked in Strasbourg before. He was, I would call him, a serial entrepreneur. He was the kind of person who brought together money people to finance his ideas. And he had a project to make these really crazy things called pilgrim mirrors, which were used.
I was going to ask about those.
Yeah, they're fantastic things. And there's an image of one on my website. They were little mass-produced metal badges, kind of trinkets, and he invented a system for polishing a stone to be reflective. And what the faithful pilgrims did, who would come in their thousands to these places and worship the shards of the true cross and whatever relic, they would hold them up to catch the holy rays. So it's an amazing world that they lived in. But you're right. I mean, I think that he was a kind of person, at least as I imagine him based on the evidence that we have from his many lawsuits, is that he was a driven person. He was an inventor. He wanted to get to the end and produce this product, and he had to navigate this incredibly complex political situation and get the money for this very, very expensive, complex, and, you know, like any invention, you don't know it's going to work. Mm-hmm. You just keep pouring money into it until you finally get somewhere.
Yeah, well, his complex psychology, to the contrary, notwithstanding, this guy was not just driven, but he was also a visionary. I mean, this guy really is complicated. He has very admirable things about him. And occasionally in his dealings with the people in his shop, Peter and the people working under Peter, there are moments of true camaraderie. There are moments of true joy and love among these people. And there are moments when Guttenberg comes in like a total jerk and just makes everybody feel miserable.
Well, I think that one of the relationships that matter to me in the book were the relationship between the master and the apprentice. And in the medieval period, the master was responsible for the apprentice in loco parentis. They were, in law, their parent. So there was a very tight relationship. And I do think that Peter and Guttenberg together had this creative drive that made them very, very close. But Guttenberg was a very hot-tempered person, and we know that because he had a lawsuit against him in Strasbourg by a woman who sued him for breach of marriage contract. And he had alleged, apparently he had promised this wench that, you know, he would do right by her, and he didn't, and she sued. He did win, but he was fined by the judge for the foulness of his language. He apparently, you know, lambasted some poor witness with his tongue. So I thought and he drank quite a bit. It's documented that vast quantities of wine came in. So I think, you know, he was a mercurial character, like a lot of leaders. I mean, if you think about the great artists, the great inventors, a lot of these people are, shall we say, a little lacking in emotional intelligence. They're absolutely blinkered and, you know, focused on the goal. And human relationships are not that important to them.
Yeah, or also just arrogant SOBs, yeah.
Well, that too.
On the spectrum, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, for the days when wench was a job description.
Exactly.
Right? Yes.
What are you, wench? Oh, yeah. Master wench or apprentice wench? I hope I'm not reading too much into this, but I got the feeling in this book that you are very much for the people, the working people, and very much against, quote unquote, the elders who are the laic rulers of Mainz and probably of most of the places in Europe at that time. But they are totally in cahoots with the church. They support each other, and you pay taxes to both of them, and if you don't, then the archbishop will tell you you're going to hell. So they really had everybody by the throat.
Yeah, I felt that the grievances of this artisan class, of the working people, I mean, and Mainz was one of the most important cities in the Holy Roman Empire, because Dietrich was the kingmaker. He had the last vote. He picked the king. So his court had been extremely glittering, and it's by the time of our story, because of the plague and for other reasons, it had fallen into sort of decay. But he was, in fact, he exploited the situation. You know, to this day, the Roman Catholic Church does not pay property tax.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so basically the laboring class creates the wealth. And then, you know, the wealthy class exploits it. And of course, I definitely felt that there was a parallel with, you know, the military-industrial complex to some extent, if you could use that for today, or the corporate interests. You know, it's just rent-seeking. And there's always going to be, economic interest is, unfortunately, the underpinning of most social relationships. And these guys were in a position of total monopoly power. And, of course, I cited, and I think Guttenberg, too, you know, he was born into that class, but because he had four grandparents, like us all, one of his grandparents was of common blood, not of elder blood. So he was ejected. He wasn't allowed to join the companionship of the mint that his ancestors had been in. And I think that also had a very deep impact on his character as a kind of a chip on his shoulder against this whole system. And he really straddled both of those worlds. He was an honorary member of the Strasbourg Goldsmiths Guild. You know, he honored the worker because he knew, I mean, they enabled his vision. I don't think one of the things that I would say, like, Holy Roman Empire was neither Holy Roman nor everything that you read about Gutenberg on Wikipedia is wrong, practically. You know, he was not a goldsmith.
Wikipedia wrong? No. I'm short of breath here.
I know. Well, even in the legitimate history books, it's sort of we've piled every attribute for the making of this glorious book on this one human being. And he was a visionary genius. He invented it. There's no doubt about it. But he was not an artist. He was certainly not a good businessman. He left a trail of lawsuits in his wake. I did think a little bit of about our friend who ran the Ponzi scheme, Bernie Madoff, while I was writing this book. Because he had come and fallen right in the middle of the composition of the story. And I thought, yeah, you know, Gutenberg really didn't care where the money came from. You know, he was just, and as you say, going back to the bond issues, the famous indulgences, Gutenberg also, because this project took so long and was so costly, and he had a partner who eventually started saying, "Where's the book? Where's the book? I've given you hundreds of thousands of dollars in those days."
Gilders.
And, yeah. You know, Gutenberg had to start doing a little bit of job work on the side to you know, balance the books, because he was in charge of the whole operation.
They printed Latin grammars?
That was the first printed book was a Latin grammar. Yeah. The first printed book was not the Bible.
Right.
That's why they say the first major printed book. But it was the test run. And, you know, he invented, his insight was, he invented mass production long before Henry Ford,
mm-hmm.
you know, making the same thing. And he understood, you know, a mass market paperback. This was a, every kid had that school book. It was a real, it was a bestseller of the Middle Ages, you know, yeah. So.
I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Alix Christie. Her first name is spelled A-L-I-X, last name C-H-R-I-S-T-I-E, got that right. And the title of the book is Gutenberg's Apprentice, published by Harper. I'm thinking of a German about 400 years later who said people are defined by their relationship to the means of production. It worked back then as well, didn't it?
Yeah.
We learned a little bit about Peter's life. Peter started out as a scribe, as you said, and he was good at it, and he liked it. He was in Paris. What's not to like? Paris, even in the 15th century, was Paris.
Paris was the biggest city in the world at the time.
Yeah.
It was the most exciting place.
Yeah. Yep. And he discovers, well, once he figures out what his foster father, Johann Fust, wants him to do, he's conflicted about it because he doesn't quite know whether this is really the word of God or not that he will be working on. And in fact, at various times in the story, people say, this is not the Bible. This is blasphemy. This is, you know, tell us a little bit about that.
So it's, again, you have to put yourself back into that medieval consciousness, which was really hard for us now to understand because we are grown up in the industrial age and we understand production of things. For them, the scribe's work, and this is, goes back to Peter's deepest character, in order to be a clericus, which he was, he had to study the four lower orders of theology. So he was a religious man. He, when you copied scripture, which he did partially because he had some relationship to the Abbey of Saint Victor in Paris, he also worked for the lay university. So he did both scripture and lay texts. But the scribe in the monastery communicated the word of God through his body. You know, it was considered a spiritual practice. The objective was not so much to turn out books. The objective was to take in the word of God and put it out on parchment. So it was really a very holy act. So then when he's confronted with this mechanical operation, which, you know, think about the foundry and what a foundry was like in those days compared in a stable with stench and heat compared to, you know, the cloisters, which are filled with light. There's just that sort of demonic element to it. But more to the point, people in those days, it took 2 years for a scribe to write a Bible. In those same 2 years, they could make 180. And to them, it seemed like black magic.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, they couldn't conceive of how it could be possible because there was no mechanization. I mean, the Cistercians had begun doing certain things with pump water pumps and irrigation. And there was, you know, stuff in the agricultural realm that was manufacturing, but mostly everything was done by hand.
Now there were carved wooden templates for printed books. Is that correct?
Yes.
They didn't work out so well.
Well, you know, they weren't. You sure couldn't reuse them. You know, wood does wear down very quickly. So, but there was a lot for many centuries. The Dutch claimed printing for their own, based on some of this very early printing that came out of Holland that was woodblock printing. And they used woodblock printing to make playing cards and textiles. And so, you know, all of the inventions that were there were in the kind of the air du temps. And Gutenberg's incredible intelligence was just to repurpose stuff and bring it together. He used a wine press. He modified it for the printing press. The idea of casting metal type, though, was really one step very far in advance because bookbinders had punches. They had carved letters to put on spines, and they knew how to carve. They carved punches to make coins. So these technologies were in use but separate. He brought it all together.
One of the things I gleaned from this also is that, like the anonymous craftsmen who built the great cathedrals, the people in this shop, the people who were printing this Bible, felt they were really doing God's work, that this was a calling. It wasn't simply a money-making gesture, which, you know, has its own repercussions in this little group, mm-hmm. but that they were literally doing the bidding of God to do this.
No, I think it's true, and I think there's a section in there where I quote from an actual monastic document from Durham Cathedral, and it talks about the work of the scribe, and it's about the emptying out of the scribe is a conduit, and there's no ego. you know, and they didn't sign things. I mean, eventually they did. Scribes would get a little bit cranky when they were tired and their backs hurt, and they would write really funny things in the margins, and occasionally they would sign them. But yeah, no, because the guilds, it was a very different kind of competition. Per se didn't really exist. They basically carved up a market, and this is why today I still find it interesting. You know, you'll have all the coppersmiths in a row selling the same goods, but you know, they're not head to head. They might each have their little specialty, but they basically carved up the market and shared. There was a great communal spirit. It was a communal period of time, and I think this is the thing that I worry about, you know, in the technological revolution that we're in now, is that we are have gone from that collective medieval period to the individualism of the Enlightenment, and now we're at this kind of radical individualism where we have personal technology that allows us to live in our complete little bubble and not, you know. So ironically, we're more connected than ever, but less connected. And so I did want to, I wanted to honor that relationship of the team, because that to me is the most interesting thing about what I discovered about this story that no one's really ever heard, is that this great man theory of history, this lone genius thing, is really a bunch of hooey, you know. It's always been teams, you know, and there's someone who claims the credit, but, you know, he could never, it was 1,282 pages. Mm. It took vast sums of money, tons of time, and as I said, you know, they had to keep it secret. It was a dangerous undertaking.
And there's also personal matters in here. Peter is a young man. He has been living for a while in a monastery. Comes out of the monastery and, you know, he starts to see girls. There's a wonderful young woman named Anna Pinsler that catches his eye. But there's a problem. And this to me, at this remove, seems silly. But tell us what the problem is with Anna Pinsler.
She's from the wrong class.
How about that?
You know? And Peter's father, being a very ambitious, up-and-coming, kind of frustrated person, because he's made as much money as any of this ruling class, but it's like the nouveau riche today. You can't really buy your way into old money. They still will look down on you, no matter what. And he's gained a lot of social standing. And I didn't know anything about Peter's personal life beyond the fact that he had been orphaned. He was a farmer's son. This is true. His exact relationship with Fust, no one really knows. But I thought, boy, a 25-year-old man. We know that he married Fust's daughter much later, when he was about 40. But that's a long time. He had to have had an eye for the women.
One
and
hopes.
Yeah. And she's like him, Anna is like him. She's a craftswoman. She works with her hand, and she celebrates the beauty of God through painting in the same way that he does through scribal work, she thinks.
And she has a little saint-like face.
Yes, she does. She does. Well, I like to contrast sort of the rooted earthiness mm-hmm. of that period. And I think it was also an unconscious way of writing, is sort of in contrast to the digital, the physical. Always come back to the physical creation of the book and the type and the day-to-day life, you know, in a very agricultural place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, the process you described for printing and the trial and error and the mistakes and it's very arduous. But you have a history yourself as a printer, and I assume that informed your knowledge of the process. Can you describe the process a little bit for us?
The process is fundamentally had not changed from the time of Gutenberg until the middle of the 20th century, when photocomposition came in. The basic principle of letterpress is you have a piece of metal type, you put ink on it, you use some kind of force to impress that letter into a piece of paper. And the thing that the scholars don't know exactly is at what point the technology, as it's demonstrated now at the Gutenberg Museum, there's a very important invention, probably the key invention, in fact, was this hand, what's called the hand caster, which was a thing you held. You poured the molten type into the mold, which was held. And it allowed you to mass produce letters very quickly. That, no one knows exactly when it came in. And the thing that started me off on this entire wild goose chase, I would say, treasure hunt, really, was some research about how those letters, the initial letters, were actually made. And some scholars at Princeton published this in 2001. And they said, you know, we've scanned all of these letters from not only the Gutenberg Bible, but from a papal edict, a bull, into the computer and analyzed them. And there is no way that they all came from the same mold. They're all slightly different. So we think that in the early part of the development of this technology, they didn't have a solid metal mold that would create exactly identical letters. It had to have been a little more rudimentary.
A one-use mold or a two-use mold?
Yeah, that you would have to break it and make it new every time.
Right.
And this was what initially piqued my interest because, as you say, I am a letterpress printer. My grandfather was a type founder. He ran the West Coast's largest type foundry through most of the 20th century, from about the 1920s to the 1960s. And so I printed with him from my teenage years on, and we made lots and lots of books. And I had never actually cast type because it's now, you know, that process became mechanized in the Industrial Revolution, and there were steam-driven presses and all kinds of things up to the middle of the last century. So I hadn't actually cast any type, but I certainly printed a lot with him.
One night in 1959, in the summer, I actually worked at the New York Times printing facility in Times Square before they moved, and they still had the hot lead linotype machines, which were the most amazing thing I've ever seen.
Yep.
The presses were pretty impressive also, no pun intended. But that it was truly remarkable to see what the process was and to load these enormous rolls of paper and print the New York Times on that thing. Enormous noise and clatter and ink everywhere. And okay, enough about me. After all is said and done, after the problems with the church, after the problems with interpersonal relations, after the problems with Gutenberg. By the way, why is he also Gensfleisch? What is what?
The people in the upper classes were known by the names of the homes in which they lived. So he was Johannes Gensfleisch zum Gutenberg.
Got it.
That meant his father had bought the house zum Guten, the Hof zum Gutenberg, and taken that on. They actually had tons of monikers that kind of went on and on, you know. But I think he wanted to go by Gutenberg because he didn't really want to be part of this whole old-timers, elder, upper-class thing. And he was a self-made man. Yep. That was his view of himself.
So it was like a German noun. It just goes on forever. Yeah.
Exactly. And you wait for the verb to come at the end.
Comes the, the August Fair, the Autumn Fair.
Yes.
That's it, yes.
Yes.
What was the Autumn Fair, and what went on at the Autumn Fair?
So this was one of the most fun parts for me to research, really. I got to go to Mainz. I went to Frankfurt. In Frankfurt, for hundreds of years, there was a giant fair, which was the trade fair for the entire continent of Europe, and it was the largest fair in the world, and every single good you can imagine was bought and sold there. And merchants came in caravans from Poland, from Scandinavia, from England, sold everything there. So, including manuscripts. There had been, since probably about the 1100s, a manuscript market down near the Lennard's Church, near the River Main. So that had been going on for years and years. And what happened was, and we know this because a letter has been discovered, written by the later Pope Pius, that sometime in the autumn of 1454, it would have been either at the fair or 3 weeks later, there was an exceptional gathering of all the princes of the Holy Roman Empire to talk about crusade, because the Pope and the Kaiser were begging the princes to unite to go and revenge themselves against the Turks who had just taken Constantinople. So there was this ongoing political crisis, and there was the regular business fair. I think that his name was Ennio Silvio Piccolomini. He was the secretary to the Kaiser at the time, Frederick III, and he was an Italian prince. He became the Pope. He wrote this letter to a Spanish cardinal, which was right at the time, the same year, saying, I have seen this most miraculous man in Frankfurt. He doesn't say the fair, in Frankfurt. He was selling books. I'm afraid they're all sold out. I'll try to get you one. But they're the most amazing things I've ever seen. The type is so large and clear, you can read it without your glasses. So he proved, and this letter had been printed centuries ago in his letters, but it was rediscovered about 30 years ago. And that really helped prove that the Bible had been done a full year before this terrible lawsuit that tore the partnership apart. And that was important because it showed us that the money was coming in. They had sold them all. Fust could have been paid up. Gutenberg could have paid Fust back, but he chose not to. So the story was much more complicated than people think. People think that Fust and Schuffer stabbed Gutenberg in the back, took his press, destroyed, you know, took his entire...
Trithemius actually asks that.
Yeah. And that is the story. Forget Wikipedia. If you go into the Encyclopedia Britannica today, that is the story that has come down for 500 years. And I just felt it's high time that these maligned people you know, got their due. And there's been a lot of scholarship in the last 30 years. You know, that's the fun thing about being a novelist of historical fiction is you get to draw the whole big net around all the pieces. There was another really interesting book written in German by a young legal scholar of the Middle Ages who reinterpreted the documents for the lawsuits. It's called Gutenberg Before the Judge, Vor Gericht. And he says, if there was any sharp business, it was Gutenberg who did the sharp business. You know, he didn't contest the lawsuit. He walked away. So coming back to Frankfurt, it was presented. We don't know if Fust went. I'm assuming Gutenberg presented it. I think Peter probably went. So that's how I tell the story. And they presented this thing to an amazed public, who had to have been amazed, and suspicious. The clergy were suspicious. But very quickly, it had already sold out.
So here I am thinking, this is a story where everybody knows how it comes out, more or less, right? So it's in the telling that you really have to do the work. Do you prefer to work that way, or do you like having the Sacco surprise ending?
You know, as a journalist by training, I've been writing fiction for about 15 years now, and what I've learned as I look back at what I'm interested in is that I am interested in taking real stories and examining the inner life, the underlying story, because as a journalist, you can really only display the factual material and then why people do things. So we know, that was the challenge, of course, we know the Gutenberg Bible exists. But to me, the interesting thing is, how did this thing come into being? And more importantly, why did it blow up? Here are these three men who came together to do this extraordinary thing, really changed the world. Most important invention since the wheel, according to Time magazine and everybody else. And yet, it blew up in their faces. So I was really interested in trying to imagine my way into their characters and say, you know, what drove them? What destroyed them? You know, what drove them apart, what drove them together, and what was the role of the church in all of this, the outside pressures that were so extreme, you know. It was a really unbelievably interesting time.
Yes, and as we know from Greek myth and Roman plays and Shakespeare, people are pretty much the same.
Exactly.
And have been for thousands of years.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I, you know, in the history of the human race, you know, 500 years is a blink of an eye. Mm-hmm. And, you know, their consciousness was different, in the sense that their vision of what man was different because of their religiosity. But, you know, they loved their children. They wanted to get ahead. You know, they wanted to defend their fatherland. And they behaved emotionally in exactly the same way we do, I think.
It's really been fun speaking with you. I've been speaking with Alex Christie, A-L-I-X, got it right that time. The title of the book is Gutenberg's Apprentice, and it's just about what you think. And it was published by Harper. Before I let you go, what are you working on now?
Another historical novel. And this one will be set in the Rocky Mountain West, so not so far from here. It's going to be about my ancestors who were Scottish emigrants who became fur traders in the middle of the 19th century and intermarried with the Native American tribe.
Nothing to do with the Donner Party.
No. They're all done. They're all et.
Thanks so much for coming.
It was a great
Alex.
Pleasure, Ed. Thanks.
You've been listening to Author, produced at the studios of All Classical KQAC-FM in Portland. My name is Ed Goldberg. You can find these programs at our website, allclassical.org/author. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back soon.